Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. Today, I'm excited to share my conversation with Kevin Smokler. Kevin and I have known each other for years, and for all that time, I've known him primarily as an author, as a writer. In the last couple of years, he's been working on this project that is now complete, and it's a documentary movie. It's called Vinyl Nation, and it's a documentary that talks about the resurgence of vinyl records and the whole community around that, from Record Store Day to record stores to all kinds of things. I got an early look at the movie, and it's amazing. I was just taken aback, not just by the topic, which I have an interest in, but just by the unbelievable narrative and the way this movie was put together. So what he and I discussed in this interview was really two things. One is, how on earth does someone who is an author take on the project of making a film, a real, unbelievably high-quality movie, a documentary, no less, which I think is such an impossible task. So we talk a lot about that creative process, and in doing so, there's so many lessons that he shared about what it means to take on a project, collaborate with other people, and really get it done, and to create something that is kind of magical. And that's what he's done with Vinyl Nation. By the way, I'll put it up front. You can find out more about the film at vinylnationfilm.com. The other thing that we talk about is really some of the themes that he found in that topic. So we talk a lot about this idea of media and our connection to something like a physical book, a physical album. And he shared some of the lessons he found in the journey he's been on in really interviewing dozens of people to figure out what is going on, what has brought back vinyl records to become this thing that really people love and people have built new businesses around and have this incredible affection for. And I thought there was a lot in there about our connection to creative work. And if you listen to the podcast, you know I focus on dealing with writers and artists and musicians. There's so much in here about the creative process from the inside. And then also, what does that work mean? How do we come in contact with great writing and great art and great music? I will note that there's some cursing in the episode, so just note that up front. You might want to turn down the volume at certain points. Up to you, nothing crazy, but I want to note that up front. All right, this is my interview with Kevin Smokler. Hey everyone, this is Dan Blank. I'm excited to be chatting with my friend Kevin Smokler. Welcome.
Hey Dan Blank, how are you, man?
Good. All right, so you have this huge milestone going on right now, which is for a while now you've been, you know the right word, you've been producing, directing, putting together like a movie, a documentary movie.
Yes, exactly. I am the co-director and co-producer of this movie, along with my filmmaking Christopher Boone, who is the other co-director and co-producer.
How long has this project, like when did the project start?
The project started in early March of 2018, so a little over 2 years ago. I was an artist in residence at the Ragdale Foundation, which is in Lake Forest, Illinois, in the north suburbs of Chicago. And I had just come off touring for my previous book, Brat Pack America, A Love Letter to 80s Teen Movies. And so really, like, the residency couldn't have come along at a better time, because I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, and I figured I was just going to give myself the freedom to kind of mentally wander far and wide and see what I came up with. And in the course of that, Chris and I talked on the phone a couple of times. We had gone to college together, but Chris is 2 years younger than me, so we didn't have all that much overlap there. But yet he had invited me to Albuquerque, where he lives with his family, while I was on book tour. And he says, hey, listen, I'm connected into the local filmmaking community here in Albuquerque, and I have a good relationship with the local art house movie theater. Why don't you come to Albuquerque? We'll show The Breakfast Club or Heathers or pick your 80s teen movie of choice, and we'll talk about it afterwards and sell some books. And that sounded great to me. I wasn't familiar with Albuquerque other than the airport you landed at on your way to Santa Fe. Not only did I get to know Albuquerque, but I got reacquainted with Chris, and it was very clear to me that we worked really well together. And so I said, quite offhandedly, when we were talking on the phone while I was at Ragdale, why don't we work on something together sometime? And he said, well, like what? And I said, well, maybe we should make a movie. Because Chris had made a movie that I had seen, a 2013 film called Cents, as in dollars and cents, that I just loved. And I like to – he has a better description of it than I do. I like to say it's Mean Girls meets Wall Street, but it's basically about a group of teenage girls who use math to rig a fundraiser at their school. And it's awesome. It's like a great movie. And so
I want to note one thing in that, which is that it started with this idea of, like, whenever you look at a successful writer, creator, they'll talk about their inner circle or their friendship, whatever. And I think it's such a powerful point to recognize that you are just sitting there with him and you're recognizing, I get along with him. We talk well, we collaborate well. I'm going to recognize that. Two, I'm just going to say it out loud, like, hey, maybe we do something together. That alone feels like a huge, like, everything. It's like Paul McCartney saying, like, hey, John, you want to come over, bring your guitar? Like, without that moment, nothing else happens.
Quite so. And I think the cases, it's a certain kind of relationship. So I feel like siblings can do this for some reason, because we have a number of pairs of, you know, filmmaking brothers or musician sisters that are in bands together. Siblings can seem to do this. People who know each other, respect each other, but are not best friends can do this, which is Chris and I. Like, Chris and I, we have both said out loud, our creative relationship is very much based on us not being best friends. We like each other a great deal, but, like, if we had been best friends since we were 11, it wouldn't have worked. I mean, I don't know why that is, and this is no slag to my best friends, but that's neat. I have people who I would walk to the ends of the earth with and whom I would never make a movie with. Like, it's just not the way that relationship manifests itself best.
I want to pause on that too, because I think that's really powerful. I talk to a lot of writers, and sometimes we talk about the support system. And I've talked to people who will say, oh, it's my spouse. They read everything, and whatever. And I'm always amazed at that. I'm like, wow, that's great. And I've talked to a lot of people too who are genuinely having a difficult time because their spouse or their sister does not support their work. And I've always made the point to them, which is, why put that role upon them? For them to be a great sister, a great husband, a great whatever, they need to also be this great creative partner. So I think it's neat that you made that distinction too, where sometimes you don't want it to be a best friend because that screws up the best friend relationship.
Yeah, and you have to be very kind of cold and empirical about what the nature of the project is. A film is long hours together with other people, and the focus is constantly changing. What you do before you make a film is different than what you do during the making of the movie is what you do different than after the making of the movie. So it has to be someone where the relationship you have is not defined by the specifics of the project. It has to be able to adjust, because movies have all of these different stages to them. That may not be the case with something that is a little bit more linear and singular, like if you guys are carving a sculpture together. You know, you have a block, and then at some point it's a sculpture, and that's the end of it. Like, so it has to, you have to be very, very cold and analytical about what the project is. And then you have to say, is this person the right person to go along on that project with? In the case of Chris and I, we joke that we are very different people with very different strengths and weaknesses. I like to say, let's do this. And Chris likes to say, here's how we can do this. I am really bad at this is it. Here's how we can do this. Not because I'm an impractical person, but I kind of get stuck there. Like I get a little stuck on the, here's how we do this. So that's something I'm not good at, and that's something he's good at. The last day of our shoot, in June of last year, I got everybody together and I said, this was really important. This was really significant. This was really special. And I just want to thank you all. And Chris was kind of nervously shuffling his feet, and he was thinking, like, I got to get the car back to the airport rental place, and I got to return the gear, and I got to do this, and I got to do that, and I got to make sure I'm on the flight. And I'm just like, dude, this is, they're not a lot in the course of making a movie, but this is a moment when you have to acknowledge the emotional weight of what's happening. I'm great at that, and he's not. Yeah. And so that's important. That's important in a partnership. For the screening we just did, we had a couple of conversations as to how to divide the labor. This was a weekend digital screening. So, and finally what we came up with, he came up with it actually, what we came up with, he was like, I'm back of the office, you're front of the office. And so all the technical stuff that went into it, all the customer service stuff, making sure the whole process worked smoothly was him. The 7 days of unfiltered enthusiasm for the process, that was me. Because that's what I do well.
Yeah.
And so that was that. And by the way, I'm sure you've said this a bunch of times before, Dan, but contained in that understanding is A, trust, and B, respect. You have to know that you're – collaborator can handle their part of it, and to not ask questions and to not stick your nose in it either. Like, it's really, if you're trusting them with that division of labor, you have to let them be in charge of that part of it.
Can I just note how right you are, but also how hard, like, every team building thing in a business, every relationship, like, that's such, like, that's the it's so true, and it's so difficult.
Yeah, you know, my wife and I talk about this all the time. My wife in her profession is an expert, and she'll have people hire her, and then she'll go and do it, and they'll say, but wait a minute, why are you doing this? And like, no, you shouldn't feel like someone's wasting your money, which they don't with her, but she always says, and this is a phrase that I repeat consistently, if you don't trust what another person does well, like there's no reason for you guys to be in this relationship in the first place. Mm. Like, if you don't fundamentally trust their expertise, don't be partners. Like find some other way to relate to one another. But you don't go to an auto body garage, say, please fix my transmission. And then two days later, they come out and say, your transmission is fixed. And you'd be like, well, wait a minute. Why didn't you do this? It's like, if you knew how, then why did you bring your car in the front door? Like, why did you engage in a relationship based on the expertise of someone else if all you're going to do is poke at that expertise? Like,
So you're at this moment with Chris, mm-hmm. and you've written a bunch of books. Like, great. I know you as a writer, and what on earth makes you think that you want to get involved in making a movie? And I'll just say, as an outsider, making a movie seems like a horrible idea for everyone on the planet. It is this industry where it is so difficult to do. It's so expensive. The coordination doesn't work. It's just filled. Every movie I love, you, I read the backstory, and it's the stress, the disaster. It's just such a hard thing to succeed with.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I remember when I was about 17, I was given as a gift for something. Spike Lee took the diary that he wrote while filming Do the Right Thing and before the movie and a little bit afterwards too, and then published it as a book. And it's one of those, like, indispensable, like, here is being on the front lines of making a movie kind of book. And there aren't too many people better at that than Spike Lee. And here he is in the middle of making what is inarguably his masterpiece. And several times in that book, beginning, middle, and end, he's like, making movies is hard as shit, man. Like, why would anybody do this? Like, and it scratches a bunch of different itches. But for us, I think it was, I mean, Chris and I started very, very slowly. It was just casual conversations we had on the phone because we don't live in the same place. And at the very beginning, I said, I find it interesting that records as a technology have come back. But we're 10 years into that comeback now. So it's like, oh my God, a comeback is not a story anymore. Why isn't a story anymore? What does it mean is a story? And he goes, oh, okay. And then we just had conversations about that over and over once a week for about 3 months. And then it was okay. Well, if this was to be a movie, and for me, making a movie is a nonfiction thing because I'm a nonfiction writer. I don't know how to tell a story that isn't real. So I said, it's going to be a documentary. Is that okay with you? That's not what you do. You make narrative films. And he's like, well, sure. We'll see where we get. Now, if we had talked for 3 months and it was clear the story was just kind of sputtering out, we would have probably said, you know what? I don't think there's anything here. Yeah. Maybe we'll find something else. Maybe we'll find something else to do together, but this is not the thing. But the more we talked, the more we were like, well, maybe we should talk to this person. Maybe we should do this, and maybe we should have this. And we could sort of start to see it take shape. And a movie, one of the joys of movie making is the process. The process is incredibly long, but it's also different enough at each stage where you can kind of see the thing coming into view. And you have to really get something out of that. Like if you're the kind of person who likes to like renovate a house, like you can see, like you'll have the picture in your mind of what the house looked like before you started. And then you'll have all of these successive pictures in your mind where you're like, oh my God, now that wall has brick. And oh my God, now the roof is new. And now the doors are a different color. And pretty soon it's all of these different things coming together to form something new.
Well, this is something really cool. I've interviewed in the past Stephanie Wong Brial, who has made, I think, several documentary films. And I remember her describing it to me that when you're doing a documentary, when you're building a house, you know in the end it's going to be a house. There will be a front door, a kitchen, a bathroom. The documentary, you don't always know because you don't know what characters are going to emerge. You don't know where you're going to get lucky, where you're going to get unlucky. Was that part of your process too, which is like you have a focus, you have a theme, you have ideas, but then it's like you're kind of what's the phrase? You're like flying the plane while it's being built or something.
There's definitely that part of making documentary films. And we were cautioned by both our advisors and our investors and our well-wishers and basically everybody who knew us. They were like, A, talk to people who've done this before you have. So we did. A lot. And we asked a lot of questions. And B, and by the way, all of those people wiser than us said some version of what I'm about to say to you, which is part of making a documentary is you figure out what your movie is about while you're making it. Because a fiction film has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a script of a prescribed length. You can assign a shooting day to each page or 2 pages or 3 pages. And at some point, you're done. A documentary conceivably go on forever. You can film people until the end of time on if your subject is rich enough. So at some point in there, you're going to find out what your movie is about. And we were pretty doubtful about that. We were kind of like, no, of course we know what the movie's about. How are we going to spend all this money and hire people and go out and film all over the country if we don't know what the movie was about? So we didn't really believe that. But lo and behold, 60, 70% of the way in the middle of it, we thought it was about one thing and it turned out to be about something else. And by the way, like that's how it's supposed to happen. If you've watched even a couple of documentaries, you will quickly realize that the ones you like best – are the ones where the subject seems to be right in front of you, but afterwards you're kind of peeking on both sides of the subject, and you can see it is about something much, much bigger than that. where you're actually selling the movie short if you say, oh, well, what is The Thin Blue Line about? And you can say, oh, well, it's about the murder of a police officer in Dallas. And then you're like, yeah, but that's a 5-minute news item. Like, The Thin Blue Line is about truth and what shapes our perception of what is true. Every great documentary has something very big that it's actually about. And that is the thing you never know at the beginning. You cannot start by saying, I'm going to make a documentary about truth, and the doorway I walk in is going to be the murder of a Dallas police officer.
It's funny because that rings to me too. It's sort of like, hey, like, no pressure. You know, it's like you want to write a novel and you want this to be the novel of a generation, but you're kind of like, well, I can't do that. I have to write the story and then hope that that theme comes out somehow.
You know when you start doing this, and I think this is true of novels and it's true of paintings and plays and anything, you know that you might get in there and look and look and look for the thing that the thing is about, and you might end up with nothing. And that can happen. That is always a risk you run. And at that point, you have to say, you know what? Like, we tried. We tried. We looked. We did all of the right things. And yet, ultimately, we've kind of come to the end of the rainbow, and the pot is empty.
So you had the kind of digital screening of the weekend, and I was emailing with you that I was able to view it. And I said this in the email, but it's worth saying. And I'm even trying to understand. The movie is really good. Like, it looks gorgeous. The interviews, the whole thing. And I said to you in the email, like, I didn't know what I expected, but what you created is extraordinary. And it begs that question of, it wasn't just you and your buddy with a couple iPhones. So there was a team behind this somehow.
Yeah.
How did you get from you two to whatever the team was that actually helped you create this thing?
So one of the very first conversations Chris and I had were, what can you do? What can I do? And what can we not do? And since he had been there before, he had a better sense of the people you would have to have involved. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very early conversation with us. Neither of us were shooters, so we were going to need a cinematographer. And because we were both relatively inexperienced, me a lot more inexperienced than him, we would need someone who was not only experienced as to how to run camera on a set, but also someone who brought their own aesthetic to the table. Because we did not have an idea of what we wanted the movie to look like. We just didn't know. It may have been different if he had said, oh, well, I really want the movie to look like this, but neither of us had any idea. So we knew we were going to need a cinematographer with a very strong point of view. And we had not a lot of money. And so we were kind of like, okay, who can we afford? And we basically asked around with cinematographers who had shot music documentaries before, because that's what we had. And we ended up finding Sherry, who is our genius of a cinematographer, Sherry Koch, and we found her because we had actually hired a friend of hers who ended up getting a much fancier, high profile, and better paying job than working on our movie. And so we're like, well, we understand, but do you know anyone else? And she sent us to Sherry. And
Wait. This is important. Did you actually say, do you know anyone else? And that, and only then is when they mentioned her name?
Yeah.
I just want to pause on that because that's so huge. There's so much times in life where people say the agent rejecting me, whatever, horrible thing. And then they do the genius thing that you did, which is like, I accept that. Is there anyone else I should talk to? And it leads to success. So I just want to note how genius that was.
I feel like you will always be discouraged if you feel like the house has one door. If you feel like the house has exactly one door, you will just be standing there on the front lawn like, ugh. But if you feel like the house has windows and maybe an attic entrance or a chimney, or maybe you can tunnel underneath it into the basement or something like that, I think you're just more alive with the possibilities. And so when she said, you should talk to my friend Sherry, I mean, we could have talked to Sherry and she could have been too much money, or she could have not understood what our project was about. We could have been like, oh, for Christ's sakes, we're going to spend 6 weeks with this person. What if we just plain don't get along? Like, that would be bad. And Sherry is so smart and has such a strong visual style that Chris and I were like, at first we were like, oh, for God's sakes, like, is she gonna feel like she's just dragging us behind her? Mm-hmm. And so at the beginning, like, we were like, she's just thinking on a level up here and not where we are. And so we had several conversations with her on the phone. And finally, we were literally like, well, we know she's good. She's in our price range. And we're just going to have to run to catch up because it's getting late and we need to get going with this thing. So
I want to make a point with that, too, which is, yeah. I mean, I've heard the thing of like always like surround yourself, people smarter than you, that sort of thing. Yeah. It's again worth noting that you liked her because she had a point of view. She was so skilled, and you'd rather you feel like you're behind to let her lead than what I think a lot of people do, which is they have power issues. It's my movie. I'm not going to let her run away. And they don't hire her because they're already freaked out by the power dynamic. So good on you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the world is unfair, and the world, the way movies work is we watch movies and we think that the person whose name follows directed by did everything. And that's ridiculous. Like that 6.5 minutes of credits that rolls by is not people who just like showed up for the free donuts. Like those are people who made the movie what it was. So we knew this is a small movie with a small crew. Chris and I are relatively inexperienced. We need the best people our money can buy. And we didn't have a lot of it. So like we need, and for this movie, which is about the comeback of Vinyl Records, the music had to be great. Like you can't have a movie about the comeback of records, which is by definition about a love of music, and have the music be bad. And so thankfully Chris had worked with a woman on Sense who he had found because she composed the score for Ava DuVernay's first two films. And he's like, we should see if we can get Catherine Bostick. I worked with her on Sense and she's fantastic and she's a great composer. And we called her and essentially like she's gone on to much bigger and better things than we had done since then. And so she quoted us her pretty standard price, and it was more than we could pay. But we're like, she's great. She's great. We will see if we can scrounge the rest of her money up. And we did. And at the same time, we had been talking to a music supervisor named Morgan Rhodes, whose podcast I was a huge fan of. And I said, I bet Morgan would be a good person to interview for this because she has a relationship with Vinyl. She has a unique perspective as a music supervisor, has a great speaking voice. And so we're like, Morgan would be great. And we started talking about Morgan being an interviewee in the movie. And then Chris said, maybe we should just ask Morgan if she could be our music supervisor. And I was like, so long as she won't be insulted, because we cannot afford her. We know that right now. Mm-hmm. And I said, I mean, I didn't ask her what she charged, but I'm like, Morgan was the music supervisor on Selma. Morgan is the music supervisor on Dear White People, the Netflix series. I'm like, this is no, like she's playing in a higher league than us. And so we asked her, and she was basically like, if I do this and this and this and move and you know, and maybe fit it in here and there and we can get into the schedule, I can make it work. And it was what she said, which we thought was really dead on, is, and we heard this, by the way, from every one of the talented professionals who worked on our movie. She said, I would love to work on your movie for less than what I can get paid by a big flashy movie with a bunch of money, but I get to focus on the creative stuff then. The stuff, the administrative gunk that comes along with my role in doing your movie, you got to find someone else to do it, or you got to do it yourself. And we heard that from every single person who worked with us, and we're like, we are more than happy to take the gunk off your hands if it means our little movie gets to work with a superstar like you.
That's amazing, because too, I think a lot of times people assume the motivation. They assume money, stature. And I think it's such a powerful thing that what these people are saying is they have that in other places. They want to feel creative. If you can help them feel creative, they will lower their rate, blah, 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 because that's a motivator for them. That's really powerful.
It was. And you know what? Like a lot of these people have agents and representatives, and those agents or representatives or managers have to look out for their careers. And if one of those people had come back to us and says, I'm sorry, this is my quote, it's bad for my career to drop my rate for your project, as noble as I think your project is, we would have said, we understand that.
Yeah.
Because we, filmmaking is inherently a collaborative medium. And if you want good people, and by the way, like, this is true with more solitary creative professions too. My friend Praveen Madan, who owns the Booksmith in San Francisco, one of the nation's great bookstores, says, like, I asked him, like, what business lessons did you have to learn when opening the Booksmith? And he said, we had to pay people more than the going rate. And I said, how come? He goes, because you don't get B people in their careers to do A work for C money. It just doesn't add up. And so somewhere you have to make an adjustment for them. If you want an A person to work for B money, they better be doing only the A++ things. They better, or they get to decide how they want to spend their time. If they're a creative person, they probably want to spend most of it being creative and not pushing paper around. So we pushed most of the paper, and we were – not all of it, but we pushed most of the paper, and we were happy to do it because we knew that our little movie was going to be that much better. And we look – and Chris and I are very vocal about that. When people say, why did your movie look so good? We're like, it's because we had a genius for a cinematographer. Why did your movie sound so good? Is because we had Morgan Rhodes as the music supervisor and Catherine Bostick as a composer. And that's just, I mean, that's having Kobe and LeBron on the same team. Like, that's crazy. You don't get those kind of rights and privileges as a first time documentary maker. You count your blessings when that sort of thing comes along.
So, you know, you and I have talked a lot about music in the past, and I feel like a personal connection to this theme. So you have this story that you're curious about and your co-director is curious about, and we have this thing, and you made a really good point, which is like, well, the resurgence of vinyl and record stores, it's not a new story anymore. It's been happening for a while. A lot of people have covered it. Why was this something that you wanted to really invest a couple years of your life, invest all that stuff? What's the story here that's compelling to you?
I think the thing that really, really got my curiosity going was, why this particular technology in this particular area of culture? We do not feel this way about VHS tapes. We don't feel this way about kinescopes or throwaway train platform paperback novels. Why do we feel this way about records? Why do we feel like relatively early in the history of recorded music, we got it right? 'Cause that is not the case with most things. That was fascinating to me. And then that was sort of phase one. And then from there, it was more a question of, okay, if records have come back, does that say anything about us as a culture, as a nation, a world of people who love music? Does it say we like big plastic round objects? Does it say we're more visual than we are auditory, or both? Does it say, I didn't know. And so I just started asking a lot of questions. And I said, And pretty soon it was clear to both Chris and I, it was like, we'll find out. We'll find out what people say to us. And when we speak to them, we'll have to ask them questions that are open-ended enough that they let us talk. We let them fill in those blanks.
I mean, what's intriguing about the movie is the emotion. And I feel like this was the surprising thing. And I've got, you know, again, long history of things, but that really jumped out at me. That, I mean, can you talk about, I don't want you to give away the movie, but can you talk a bit about that? That idea of, yeah, we're talking about a technology, we're talking about music, the music industry, the music business, talk about retail stores. These are like heartless things. Yet, the whole movie, and certainly towards the end, it's this very emotional, human-driven thing. Can you talk a bit about that? Because everyone listening to this is a writer, an artist, a creator of some sort. So they come into it with that love, but on the other end, the consumer end, you don't always get that. You get a lot of criticism, you know, get a lot of mess in the marketplace. What is the emotional side of this for people?
Well, there's a couple of different things. One, records as a technology work on four of the five human senses: smell, touch, hearing, and sight. Whereas your stream from Spotify works on exactly one: hearing, unless you really have a thing for green and black as a color combination. But like that is a more well-rounded experience. That is going to encode itself deeper into your brain and to your heart. Two, records, by virtue of being physical and by virtue of being both a surprisingly fragile technology that also manages to last a very long time. It's a weird contradiction there. Records have stories attached to them. Where a record came from, where you found it, maybe who it belonged to before you got it, before it came into your life, what memories it evokes for you. Some of those are things that digital manifestations of music do. But I think very few people have a deeply personal story attached to an MP3. They might to a song, but not to a song represented by that MP3, but probably not the technology itself. And there's no such thing as a used MP3 either. Whereas my record collection is composed of my father's records and my wife's late grandfather's records and two or three other people who are trying to get rid of records that I know that I took in. And so it's composed of all of these other people's stories, which I think is a very powerful thing and a very human thing. And then finally, there is a way that I think is important for all of us, not only people who make culture, but interact with culture. There are ways to interact with culture that are heartless and transactional. And sometimes that is necessary. Sometimes what you really want to do is spend your time watching a movie and reading a book and or listening to music and not figuring out how to bring it into your life in the first place. And that is understandable. There is also an enormous amount of joy in the human method of bringing culture into our lives. We interviewed 46 people for this movie, and of all ages, sizes, shapes, races, colors, and creeds. And not one of them said, "Do you know what is fantastic about the comeback of records? Is you can order records on Amazon the same way you can order laundry soap." Not one of them said that. They all said the great thing about records is going to the other side of town, maybe where you got a shirt dry cleaned or something, and finding a little record store and walking in and digging amongst the bins and as if it was a treasure hunt or archaeology, unearthing something. Or having a conversation with someone you would have never met otherwise. There are very few of those kind of intimate relationships around culture. And maybe at movie theaters a little bit, Definitely with books. I think books do a really good job with that, particularly in bookstores. But I think few of us are so self-contained or misanthropic that what we really want to do is take the things we love to listen to and read and watch and just hoard them all for ourselves. It is ultimately an act of sharing kind of completes the relationship.
Well, it's interesting because records used to be my biggest hobby. Me and my best friend at the time, also named Dan, for years, all we did was drive around to these record stores and search in the bins. When I had my first good job, all I did was spend money on records and CDs. And there's that element of scarcity to it. Like, I can tell you there was that 2003 vacation in Salem, the record store I went into, and the moment where I discovered they had all the original Nick Drake vinyl, which I bought, and they also had this Chameleons UK single I'd looked for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And thinking about it is like that moment. So it's not even just the guy at the record store. It wasn't very nice. There's not the connection, but it was the hunt. It was the scarcity of it. And I think Record Store Day, which is part of the movie, to me always is that same sort of thing. It's the idea that there's a limited release of some sort and you have to get it. It's scarce. There's fear of missing out. Is that a component that you noticed in all of this?
I'm gonna potentially make an ass of myself here, but like, I am going to guess that your time as an ardent record collector was before 2009.
Yeah, I got out of it cold turkey in 2010 when my son was born.
Okay.
But I will say, and we'll talk about it more in this minute, it was coupled with my unwavering obsession with audiophile gear, which we should talk about in a minute. So yeah, go on to your point, though.
So you were a product of the high fidelity generation. High fidelity, the novel, was written, I believe, in the late 90s, and the movie came out in 2001. And high fidelity positions record collecting as the hobby of weirdo eccentrics, which at the time it was a little bit like collecting stamps or fossils or classic cars. It was something that a strange subculture of people did. That period of time exists from about the coming of the CD in the mid-1980s until the comeback of vinyl in 2007. What we call the dark ages in the movie, or the interregnum, the middle period. And what you speak of is the relationship that most people had with records then. It was all about, because it was an old technology that was not being made, it was all about scarcity and treasure hunts and acquisition and having something the other guy didn't have. And I have no judgment about that. But that is an analogy.
It's very well put.
Yeah. But if you watch High Fidelity, but it is telling that was also the province mostly of white straight men. What the comeback of vinyl did was pry open the door to the hobby. And most of the people, and it expanded and diversified what our idea of a person who is into records is. And so now it's just as much women as men. It has been shown what it was all along, which is a hobby that often working class communities were into because it was cheaper. It is a hobby that privileged people who come from a kind of do-it-yourself ethic because before audio equipment, turntables and stuff was common again, you mostly had to do, you know, repairs and fixing yourself. And we found in our movie that there's a whole lot of 10 and 11 year olds who are really into records now because they're big and colorful and pretty, and same reason you and I had Fisher Price turntables probably when we were kids. So I think the neat thing revealed in our movie was the reasons people are into records are not as patriarchal as they used to be, which is it's not about I got to get mine for me, and I got to beat the other guy to it. Now, there is a part, as you pointed out correctly, there is a part of Record Store Day that is very much like that. That is very much like, I got to be first in line because there's only 200 of these and I got to get it and someone else can't get it. It's not what I do on Record Store Day. What I do on Record Store Day is I show up about 12:30 and I walk sheepishly in the door and I'm like, is there anything left? And they're like, dude, you're standing in a record store. Like, of course there is. Look at the shelves. And then I just go around and I buy a bunch of shit and I'm like, hey, isn't it cool to be in the record store on Record Store Day? But I got to say, like, the Record Store Day that we filmed in Kansas City, where people line up at 4:30 and 5 in the morning, those people have exactly the right attitude about it. Nobody is staring daggers at anybody else saying, like, you better get the hell out of the way because I need that Tangerine Dream album that is on tangerine-colored vinyl. Nobody's saying that. They're all like, hey, isn't this cool, this funny thing that we all do together, and like, and we're all different kinds of people, and yet here we are, all interested in the same hobby. Isn't it great? Like, that was, by the way, that was a microcosm of the feeling I hope our whole movie created.
There's something about music. I mentioned before, for a while, there's maybe a decade, I got really into, I guess, what you call high-end audio. So there's two components to that. There's vintage equipment. So buying amplifiers from the 60s, getting them redone, all tube gear. And then there's a thriving hobby of brand new stuff. So in that period, I probably owned 20 or 30 very high-end turntables at different times because I'd buy them used, I would try them. And it's all about this idea of fidelity. So if with a really good setup, if you have the speakers and all the turntable and everything, close your eyes, you literally feel like the bass player is in the room and he or she is standing exactly right there. And the drummer is 4.5 feet behind them and 2.5 feet to the right. And this is where you can feel it in the room. And that's what I got obsessed with. And for a long time in the apartments we lived in, the living room didn't have a TV. It had the stereo in one end and a single chair on the other end, and there's other stuff on the sides. And I would listen to music as a singular focused activity. So you put on that Shelley and Orphan or that, you know, that album.
Yeah, man.
With the intention to spend 45 minutes sitting there and doing nothing other than listening to it.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't, I mean, so that experience of music, I mean, I feel like you must have touched upon, maybe not that specifically, but that idea of the experience of music can be many things. It can be very personal, and that it's different than just, as you're saying, how I listen to Spotify now, I throw it on while I work. Can you talk a bit about that idea of music and the experience of music and the different ways that you discovered people's connection to it?
Yeah, I mean, many of the people we spoke to for this movie talked about how records require a level of attention that listening on Spotify or on your phone or something doesn't. And you got to sit down and you have to be deliberate about what you choose. And it almost commands that you pay more attention to what you're listening to. Now, I personally think that's arguable because my wife and I will make dinner or eat dinner and put something on the turntable and it's mostly background. We're deliberate in that we choose, like, there's certain kinds of music that are great background for dinner, jazz, classical, folk, singer-songwriter, and certain ones that are not, punk, heavy metal, gangster rap. We like all those genres. They don't all belong at the dinner table. And once we put the record on, we're not paying all that much attention to it. I think there's a lot to the act of just sitting on the couch or the chair or something and just paying attention only to the album. And it does give you an appreciation for how much goes into the making of an album. Like, The sad thing about Spotify is no liner notes. One of the sad things. And you don't know who produced it and who recorded it and who played drums and all that kind of stuff. And that stuff is most musicians will talk about how that was important to their appreciation for what music could do. I have a Spotify account, proudly. But I use it differently. To me, it's like an audition. You know, I sit behind the table and Spotify brings music into the room and I listen to it and I say, very well, thank you. You may pass on to the next level, or thank you, goodbye. If I don't like it enough, I send it back out the door. If I like it enough, I'll probably buy it on record. Because the record has a permanence to it that it's more expensive, of course, but B, it has a permanence to it that the library, my record library, is the Hall of Fame. It's the Hall of Fame of music that is most important to me. But by the way, like, everybody we talk to has a different attitude about that. Like, people with 9 and 10,000 records are like, my record library is every form of music that I've ever been interested in my entire life. It's my autobiography. And some people who live, you know, in a one-bedroom apartment with two roommates are like, my records are the 12 most important things to me that can fit into a plastic crate underneath my bunk. Like, because that's it. Like, that's what I have room for.
So. Yeah. Something I think a lot about when I think of the idea of record stores, of physical goods, is sustainability. So this idea that I know a lot of people talk about bookstores, record stores, and there's a sentimentality to it. And I think there's that challenge, and the challenge is now very heightened this year, of how does one sustain that? And I've heard of, and I know you've talked about this, you know, like Third Man Records, the idea of like, and I knew that really through Jack White buying some building and his weird interests and things, and then it grew from that. How does the idea of sustainability for whether it's a store or a medium or a community, how does that filter into this?
So I'm just going to start talking and you tell me if I'm answering your question. Pre-COVID, it was a pretty good time for record stores in America. And this is something we noticed because in our partnership with Record Store Day. We partnered with Record Store Day, the organization, to do our screening last weekend on what would have been Record Store Day 2020. And to do that, they communicated with all of the member record stores in the country, about 1,400 of them. And then they gave us a spreadsheet with the names of all of those stores and where they were. So we knew who we were communicating with, who we could provide the best customer service to. And what we noticed is, like, were we surprised that there are 15 record stores in Austin or Nashville or you know, New York or some music town like that? No. Were we over the moon delighted that there are 4 record stores in Sioux Falls, South Dakota? Absolutely. Like, that's the coolest thing in the world. Like, you can get, if you're really small-minded, you can be like, oh, well, are there record stores anywhere other than, like, where hipsters hang out? And the truth is, like, yeah, all over the goddamn country. Like, Dan, I'm guessing in the course of your program, you have had to remind people more than once that since pandemic lockdown, you can just as easily shop at your neighborhood bookstore as you can at Amazon. I am guessing you have had to have that conversation with people. There is an inclination that when times are bad, we need to direct our purchasing dollars at the institution. The truth is, if we want special institutions to exist after all of this is over, it might be slightly less convenient, it might cost slightly more, but we need to direct our dollars to them. We cannot get sentimental about your favorite bookstore if you don't intend on supporting them when the chips are down. And that goes for your favorite record store, your favorite restaurant, your favorite coffee shop, your favorite any small business.
It's a neat reminder, too, about community and participation. I think whenever I've gotten jaded with anything that's communal, it's often because if I look around and I say, well, 98% of the community here is passive. And that always sort of, you know, it's like when, you know, I'll go to a conference that's relatively expensive, whatever, and, you know, no one's talking. Everyone's sitting in the back, and you're like, why did you spend all the money to come here? Like, you could have done this at home.
Yeah, good question. Yeah. Absolutely.
So there's so much, there's so much I asked about that we can dig into. Are there any other themes, whether it's in the making of or the movie itself, that you feel like we should talk about but I haven't asked about?
No, I thought this was, I thought this was great. I mean, I don't know if you're going to sort of announce this at the top of the hour, or you want me to say what the movie's about, what the movie's called and how it can be seen and all that. But we are right now, we are in the process of figuring out when we can show this movie to folks again. And, because there is a, people have asked us before, well, why don't you just go ahead and put it on Netflix? And getting your movie on Netflix is like getting drafted into the NBA. Like, you have to, there's a lot of steps that happen before you can reach that level. So, we're working on those steps right now. And we hope, we can promise everybody that there will be a day in the not too distant future where the movie will be available for purchase on VOD and on DVD. Because given the subject, it would be wrong for this movie not to be available in some kind of commercial medium in some way. It's a kind of physical medium, media, I should say. But we can promise that, but that's pretty much what we can promise now. And we will keep everybody as informed. You will know as soon as we know via our website, vinylnationfilm.com.
I love it. Yeah, it's this whole thing. I was so excited to chat with you. One, because I genuinely love talking with you. But
same here, man.
The nature of what you've created matched with the topic of the movie is such a, I mean, it's just so rich. There's so much in there. But thank you for making this. I mean, I think that's the thing, is sort of like that really jumped out at me as I was watching it, is this idea of like, to make this was a choice. It was a collaboration. It was an intense risk. And it's like, that's not something you can take for granted. So I just want to say thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, man. And I really enjoy you asking. I really glad you asked, because I enjoy talking to you as much. We've been friends a very long time. And so I just appreciate this opportunity to catch up with you and hear what you're up to, and to be as helpful as I can to the community you've created, because I think it's substantial, and B, it deserves it.
You can find out more information about the film Vinyl Nation at vinylnationfilm.com, on Instagram at vinylnationdoc, and on Facebook at vinylnationdoc as well. The release date and how you'll be able to access this is still kind of in the works. They were able to do a great little promotion around Record Store Day where they did a limited release, and they're working on the rest. You can connect with and find out more about Kevin Smokler at kevinsmokler.com. That is S-M-O-K-L-E-R. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at wegrowmedia.com or on social media at Dan Blank. Thank you so much for listening until the end.